I tend to be very facetious.
Oh, no, that's fine.
So, we'll love that. Playful, because that's the way I like to live my life.
Yes.
And I like that. Sometimes living your life like that is, sometimes it's just really joyful. I mean, I learned something. My name is Jim LeBrecht.
Okay. Thank you.
I already want to talk ahead of who I am.
Yeah.
I'm best known as being a sound designer and mixer. I've been doing that. I'm 62 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I have been doing this professionally over 40 years.
Wow. Really?
So I started my career at the Berklee Repertory Theater as their resident sound designer.
Oh.
And I worked there for about 10 years, which was just a wonderful experience. And I think theater is incredible training for anybody. And often people branch out from there, or people come from science and go to theater because they can't stand science anymore.
That's true.
Was a few of the folks I met. And then I started moving into the film industry.
Okay.
And in fact, the room that we're sitting in today for our podcast is in the Saul Zantz Media Center, which used to be the home of the movie producer Saul Zantz, his post-production facility and editing rooms and such. And this is where I cut my teeth in the film industry. In the very late 80s, I started working on films as I was transitioning out of theater. I love working in film, and I really, really love sound. I founded my own audio post-production company, Berklee Sound Artists, because I wanted to do a few different things that the Film Center was doing.
Okay.
And also, on kind of the other side of all of it, like many... Really, you know, this in the entertainment business,
mm-hmm.
it's very arduous work. You know, the people that really at the top of their game, you really kind of come up working your fanny off.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing okay, kind of keeping up with everybody and stuff, but I was a little bit worried that maybe I just needed a plan B. And so starting a company was a way that I knew that, you know, if my body wasn't allowing me to go to work that day for what other wonderful reasons, that I wasn't going to fire myself
mm-hmm.
unless I got in a big argument with myself.
Yeah,
and
awesome.
So, you know, it's one of those things that kind of plays into disability is
mm-hmm.
you have to love yourself for
Absolutely.
What you bring to the table. And you can't look at disability purely as a detriment. You have to look at disability as being part of your being and that it brings things to you that people who don't have disabilities don't have the advantage of knowing.
Right.
Now, this is kind of really turning things on its head here, but
mm-hmm.
it's really what I believe. And so, you know, we all, you know, need a certain amount of, because our bodies are different than a lot of other folks, there's going to be things
right.
that, you know, you need to accommodate, or you need to say, like, I need this slack here or whatever, but I also work my ass off.
Yeah.
And I also know how fortunate, I mean, I really, you know, since I was a young kid, it was kind of like, I'm not going to be able to do a job at McDonald's, so
right,
I better
right.
really pay attention and do a good job as best I can in school, and
mm-hmm.
that I needed to have a really good work ethic, because I didn't feel like I had a safety net of anything else. I wasn't, you know, I was born with spina bifida.
Okay.
I've never been able to walk. So I've been a wheelchair user since the age of 2.
Right.
So it's not to say that, especially early in my career, I was working in theater.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to be able to listen from different areas of the theater.
Yeah.
So I was out of my wheelchair a lot, kind of climbing around the seats, listening from different locations in the theater. And
wow.
The great thing is that I was able to do that. The
right.
reason I was able to do that
mm-hmm.
was that when I was born, my parents had a split-level house in Westchester County, just north of New York City,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't move.
Oh.
They didn't move, and it was like, okay. And I kind of joked that I kind of thought that, well, maybe the conversation kind of went like this, like, gee, honey, we have to move. Well, they tell us he may not live. So why don't we just see how things work out here first? And then it's like, I can imagine the conversation that was like, Well, Robert, you know, he's, you know, 3 or 4. I said, well, he's doing pretty damn good. What's the deal?
Exactly.
And in reality, you know, eventually my bedroom and my sister's bedroom
uh-huh.
were, you know, up 3 flights of stairs in the garage.
Dang.
And I crawled up and down, and it was like, this is what I know.
Yeah. Right?
And so
yeah.
being born with a disability versus acquiring it.
Right.
You know, you're really, you're training your body, you're learning your body, you're dealing with this stuff from day one, and it's mm-hmm. not, it's not something new.
Yeah. And it's not something that people teach you, because you can't expect your parents to, you know, same thing. It's
no.
Like,
I mean.
You learn as you grow. So when was the first time that you noticed that you were different? I don't want to say, like, when you noticed you were disabled or anything, because everybody has, you know, events in their life that kind of speak to them about, well, I can't do that, or I'm not able to participate in this. Like, was it, did you have any messages from your family, or was it school, or, like, how did it play out, especially in, like, you know, New York, or where you said you were from?
I've had a very fortunate life, let me just say that up front.
Okay.
In that I was going to special school for kindergarten.
Okay.
And my teacher there really impressed upon my parents that I was so much head and shoulders above everybody else,
mm-hmm.
you know, intellectually. And
right.
That they should really try to get me into public school. And
oh.
so in the middle of first grade, I was accepted in on a trial basis
oh.
into the school district in the town of Greenburg.
Oh, okay.
And in fact, I just came across the letter that, or a carbon copy of the letter that they sent to me, and kind of saying, look, you know, we want, you know, we're willing to try this out for Jimmy, and here's what we are not responsible for,
and
such,
right.
and we'll see how it goes. And
uh-huh.
And so it went really well. And so I went to public school from the middle of first grade on.
Wow.
But in dealing with inaccessibility, the first school I went to for first and second grade was rather modern, so I didn't have issues. But
mm-hmm.
heading off to that, you know, third grade school, there were stairs to get in, stairs up and down. And so, but I got help in
mm-hmm.
that. If we had to go up to the library, my classmates carried my manual chair up, and I crawled up the stairs.
Really?
So, when did I become aware of it? Well, it started becoming, I think it just became issues for me as with anybody else, as I got older, in that you start realizing the things that aren't built for you,
mm-hmm.
and especially, you know, this is like years before the ADA
right.
or anything else, and
mm-hmm.
that... So do I remember one particular moment? Maybe
yeah.
not.
Okay.
But
okay.
But I do remember starting to come across situations where I couldn't do certain things, or maybe there was a class trip I couldn't do or something.
Yeah, right.
And realizing that it was unfair.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, at the age of 6 or 7 or 8, it's not like, well, I can understand why, because it's like, that's unfair.
Right.
I can't go. I want to go. I
exactly.
do everything else.
Exactly.
So, and I think other people with disabilities could probably nail down a time when they first kind of became aware of this, but
right.
I would certainly say that as I got older and was more independent, I was starting to really deal with issues of not being able to get on public transportation or
mm-hmm.
enter buildings and do things that all my other friends were doing,
right.
that it became, you know, obviously I understood I was disabled.
Yeah,
but
yeah, yeah.
I think maybe the point is that when does it start really becoming
mm-hmm.
an issue for you in your life?
Right, exactly.
And so when you're a kid, you're playing. You know,
yeah.
I crawl around when I'm playing. They're doing other things.
Yeah.
So, but and I think that for me, it's been a motivator in my life.
Okay.
To kind of, you know, there's this, at the age of 62, there's this little guy in there going, that's not fair.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
You can't say no to me.
Yeah, exactly. So it's actually, you've reframed it into a positive thing, right? It's been positive, and you're grateful, and that it's made you the person you are today. Because I feel the older I get, too, it's like you appreciate the smaller things, you know?
I think that really being part of the disabled community
uh-huh.
Has been what saved me.
Okay.
And I try not to sound terribly dramatic when I say save me, but it informed me greatly. And it allows me to have this attitude of pride and acceptance, and that I would not have if I didn't have other people model that for me.
Right.
And certainly with the advent of the internet and Facebook and such, I'm in touch with so many people who are involved in disability and the arts and advocacy than I ever was before, you know, Facebook. And
MySpace.
Yeah, right, MySpace. And that, but also having lived in Berkeley and worked in Berkeley for years, and this being kind of like, you know, Mecca.
Right.
For, you know, folks. I've had friends, you know, in the community, but, you know, I went to this summer camp and called Camp Jeanette, and a number of people from that camp wound up coming out to California.
Oh, really?
Judy Heumann, who a lot of us know, you know.
The mother of...
Right? So, yeah. And Judy, for those that may not know Judy, Judy is... I mean, I kind of say she's like a superstar in the disabled civil rights and independent living movement.
That's true.
And so the great thing is that, so Judy went to Camp Jeanette. That's where I first met her. And when she had graduated college, she had gotten her teacher's license.
Yeah.
And, but the school district in New York City refused to give her a position, saying that she was a fire hazard or whatever else.
Oh, yeah. I've been told
and
that
Judy sued.
She did?
And she, basically, the judge... in that case, told the Board of Education, y'all better settle.
Oh.
You know, that Judy had a strong case. And it was really this incredible victory that for us said, oh my gosh, we can actually push back and we can win. I mean,
right.
We're not always going to be treated as, you know, half humans and babies. So Judy went on to be one of the founders of Disabled in Action in New York, which was an extraordinary, still is, an organization. But when Ed Roberts was out here and kind of just starting, helping to found the Center for Independent Living, he really wanted Judy to come out here, and which she did.
Right.
So we all knew Judy from camp. We all kind of stayed in touch. And she kind of, you know, word gets back to the old country that, you know, Berkeley is like the ramps are paved in gold, right?
Exactly. Berkeley's the place you need to be.
Yeah. So we packed up our truck and
rolled
moved
our wheelchairs
Berkeley.
In the ramps.
A number of people from the camp wound up moving here, and I found community with them.
Oh.
And although I wound up going to college in San Diego, I moved up here in 1978 and to work at the RAP, and there's this community here. So it's people like Judy that really got me interested first in advocacy work.
Okay.
And that I knew. And and my career has been really tough for me to kind of stay connected at times.
Yeah.
When I was first working at the Berkeley Rep, I was just like, I didn't have time to, you know, wash my underwear sometimes. But I kind of came back to doing stuff in the community a number of years ago, and it's been really wonderful. And a project that I have been involved with the last couple of years is co-producing, co-directing with a film called Crypt Camp. I'm doing this with a great filmmaker. Her name is Nicole Noonan, and I used to work as her sound designer on all of her films. And I told her the story about this migration, the California, and she really dug into the story and said, we should make a film together.
Wow.
And I've done, you know, mixes on over 200 documentaries, so I know this world, but I haven't been a director on a film.
Yeah.
And so this story is, some of it is what I just told you
about
Judy and people moving out here. But it's basically the sense of when you're exposed to an environment in which you're encouraged to have a full, wonderful life.
Yeah.
As opposed to being told, you know, you really shouldn't set your sights very high. It's an incredible motivator.
Right.
And that you will work really, really hard to find it again if you lose it.
Mm-hmm.
And to protect it and cultivate it. And that's kind of the story that's what happened with this camp and the people from that. And a number of us were, including Judy, not including myself, were involved in a sit-in in 1977 at the HEW offices in San Francisco that lasted over 26 days to force the Carter administration to issue the regulations for HEW 504, which had been passed years ago.
Right.
That law said that if you get a drop of money from the federal government, you have to be accessible.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that sit-in is still the longest takeover of any federal building by anybody to this day.
Yeah, that's what I heard. Yeah, this day, currently, today. Yeah.
And so, and you know, what do we see in media, right? We see, like, these stories of either the extraordinary, what I like to call the super crip.
Exactly.
You know,
thank you
like
for saying
climbing
that.
Climbing half down with
right.
Two pinkies. No,
exactly.
Pinkies, right? And, or you see... What was that movie, like, You Before Me or Me Before I?
Oh, yeah,
right,
yeah,
where,
yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm really good-looking, and I've got this wonderful gal, and she's really good-looking, but I became a quadriplegic, so I still want to kill myself.
Exactly.
And
it sucks to be disabled, but pay to watch.
Yeah, forget about it. And so, and no one is seeing media, they're seeing very little media in which the real breadth of our community and what the experience of living is. As a disabled person is.
Right. No, I agree.
They don't see you and I sitting here doing a podcast.
No.
And so part of the reason for wanting to make a film is to really show disability for, you know, it's not all just triumphant, and it's not all, there's a lot of humor.
Right.
There's a lot of great examples of how we really excelled and built things that were never there before.
Yeah.
And to try to help start to shape how the non-disabled world views us.
Mm-hmm.
Don't view us as, you know, dependent on social services and that we stay home or whatever, but view us as sexy.
Yeah.
View us as smart.
That's right.
View us as the people that you want to kick back and party with or that you want to go to church with.
Right, right.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
It's like, so I'm very excited about this project, and fingers crossed, but we're in pretty good shape where we are right now, and hopefully people will see it someday down the road in the not-too-distant future.
Right.
But we're very optimistic that it's going to see the light of day.
And how has it been going from sound designer to, like, co-producer? Like, how has,
It's really interesting because... You know, I've worked on all these films, but I haven't been in the editing room.
Right.
You know, the picture editing room.
Yeah,
I've been in the sound editing room.
Yeah.
And when people come to us, their film is kind of like they've locked the cut down, and now we're ready to do all the cleanup and added sounds that you need for a film.
Mm-hmm.
And Nicole and I have been out shooting. We've been to New Orleans. We've been to New York City. We've been to Washington.
Okay.
And doing a bunch of filming around here. And, you know, being part of... All of that was really new to me. And so at first I felt really, because Nicole is really so experienced in this area, I had to just kind of feel my way around where I felt confident about my knowledge that I had and that I felt comfortable participating more and more and more, which I have. It was a good learning experience. It has been.
Mm-hmm.
But the film, to an extent, is using me as a character to kind of explain things, to kind of be the audience's view of things, and to explain and then get out of the way.
Okay.
And let the footage really speak for itself. Especially the last couple of weeks, working on the film has just been so meaty as things have really been kind of coming in and really finding their shape. And I've certainly worked on a number of films where you can say something like, you know that, you know, we have a cutaway to that person there. Do we need that? Anyway, that's a very, very minor thing to talk about. It's been incredibly enjoyable, and also seeing how the film comes together, that it's... I think it's the film that our community really is yearning for.
Yeah, it's kind of what's needed. It's a different perspective completely.
So I don't want to kind of like puff up my chest and say, ain't I so great? But I also know the stories that I've wanted to see.
Yeah.
Where we, you know, the tropes are not part of what we're doing. It's good.
Just for my own curiosity. So the camp that you're talking about, because I kind of went to a similar camp, and then the first time somebody told me that you're working on this, I was like, no, I think he's talking about my camp. And they're like,
what was your
no,
camp?
Not every disabled person goes to the same camp.
Oh, again. That's hilarious.
And I'm just like, I'm like,
right.
Oh,
we don't know each other.
Exactly. We don't know each other. So how often did you go to, was it like every summer? Like who, was it funded through the state? Like, because I even kind of wonder that now, thinking about, I'm like, how did I go to camp? I mean,
where did you grow up?
Here, in Contra Costa County.
In Northern California?
Yeah.
I went to a couple of different camps before I wound up going to Camp Jeanette. And they were kind of much more kind of straight, mm-hmm. if you know what I mean.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
kind of like, it's a dorm, not a bunk. The counselors sleep in their dorm, and I had to go to bed at 8:30. And when I was really kind of youngish, that was okay, but as you get older. And then the summer of 1969, the year of Woodstock, I heard about this other camp.
Oh.
Because some of the campers from Jeanette had to go to our camp because their dining room had burned down during the winter, and so they were rebuilding their dining room that summer.
Oh.
Now, I'm hearing about this camp where you're in a bunk and the counselors sleep there and you listen to a whole bunch of movies. I mean, you listen to, you know, a lot of different music. There's uh-huh. music playing all the time. Uh-huh. And you might be able to smoke dope with the counselors.
Oh.
At the end of that summer at this other camp, Dad, there's this other camp I heard about. I'd really like to go. Okay, Jimmy. Okay, great. But it's really a place that was a kind of the times. There's so many liberation movements going on. And
okay.
And people really started talking about that. Judy and her bunkmates were talking about this. And you know, it was the time of women's lib and gay lib and
mm-hmm.
black
mm-hmm.
power. I mean, I was like, well, what about us? What are we? And it was just a great environment. And working on this film, I want to go back to that camp, but it doesn't exist.
What?
And also the 70s don't exist anymore either. And so, you know, imagine a summer camp run by hippies. What could go wrong?
Right. Nothing. In doing my research and everything, I just assumed that people with disabilities identify as disabled, but I found out that's not the case. So a lot of people are like, oh, I'm not disabled, I just have cancer, or I'm not disabled, I just have this. And I'm just like, doesn't that affect your quality of life? How do you identify? Like, do you identify as a person with a disability, or is that something you leave out?
Identify absolutely somebody who is disabled. That is my culture.
Okay.
That is my identity.
Right.
But a point in early in college where I kind of said, you know, I'm disabled, but I've completely overcome it. Right? Like, I don't need any help.
I can
drag my wheelchair up a flight of stairs if I have to. I'm nice and strong, and no big deal. And I was at UC San Diego, and it's a large campus, and it was before we really had, there was a disabled students coordinator or anything, so I had classes that were spread out, and I was, like, worn out, like, trying to get from lower campus to upper campus,
right.
And I realized, you know, dude, you need a little bit of help occasionally, you know?
Yeah.
And that evening, the weight lifted off my shoulders.
Okay.
I just remember this moment like it was yesterday, and then I was, like, sitting in the front of the mirror getting ready to go out, and said, you know, yeah, you can accept help. You know, it's okay. And it, you know, it was kind of a big deal. And I was studying stand-up comedy about 15 years ago for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a community I still really love. But I remember one of my earlier routines was that I would say, you know, I remember when I kind of came out as being disabled, and my friend said, Jim, we knew. I mean, the wheelchair was a pit bull.
When you rolled out of the closet?
Exactly.
Yeah,
when you rolled out of the closet. Oh, that's the best one.
Yeah. So,
rolled out of the closet.
But it is actually, you know, you bring up an issue that's really kind of important to talk about, is that who identifies and mm-hmm. who doesn't, and why is that?
Yep.
And so if people look upon everybody thinking that they're pitiful or dependent or a burden or less than, then they don't want to identify. But if that's all they're seeing in the movies and on television, how are they supposed to react? But in reality, if more and more people identified,
mm-hmm.
and really, we've become a much more important voting bloc.
Right. No, yeah, you're right.
And,
absolutely.
And so how do you convince people that it's good to identify, especially people who have acquired a disability?
Exactly.
Or people who are dealing with illness.
Right.
And
there is a difference.
There is. And look, if you have an illness for a very long time, you have to look at it as, well, do I identify as just being sick?
Exactly.
Or do I identify as being having a disability?
Right.
And I really had, I worked on this great documentary called Unrest. That's about ME, also known as chronic fatigue syndrome.
Yeah.
If you ask me to pronounce what ME stands for, I have to run and find it written down. And I worked with this wonderful filmmaker, Jen Brea, who has this illness. And we had some wonderful talks during the mix about how she viewed herself and looking at, you know, am I ill or do I have a disability? And it was very meaty conversations that I think more people should have.
Yeah. And people are uncomfortable having the dialogue, but I feel like it's a necessity because it also affects how we sense if we belong or not. Like, I'm very curious to know, like, do you think you were accepted because you are a man more so than disabled women? Because there's a big discrepancy between disabled men and disabled. Like, society thinks, oh, if you're disabled and you're a guy, you just marry your caregiver and live happily ever after. Right?
Yeah.
Which irritates me tremendously. But if you're, you know, disabled female, you're going to be single forever and, you know, you're not sexy and you're not desirable and yada, yada, yada. So do you think gender, you know, we're talking about all these other aspects. Do you think...
Imagine being a woman of color with a disability or being queer.
Right.
And I do a lot of reading of a lot of different people online, and I read the experiences of women with disabilities and people from the LGBTQ community, and it's like you're hit with a double, triple, quadruple whammy.
It sucks.
And so, not to be flippant about anything, but it's almost like, thank God I can't walk so I can actually be in this room as a white man, older white man who's turning gray, like that I have something that kind of says, okay, maybe he's not so bad.
Right. You just like move up to the top of the totem pole.
Yeah,
right?
Well, yeah, for an old white guy, exactly. I have some cred, you know?
Yeah, right. You're OG. You're
boss. But I was literally talking to some friends about this last night. It's just like, I have a different perspective on life, which has given me an advantage.
Yeah.
And then I don't think that if I was born with a disability, I don't think you and I'd be talking.
No, I'm convinced.
You know, I think I would have probably wound up working on the loading dock at the furniture warehouse down on Four Corners in Hartsdale, New York.
Right.
Drinking a six pack of Schaefer's every night.
Exactly.
Until I had my heart attack.
Right. No. That's true.
So I'm.
Somebody just asked me yesterday, like, do you think that you would be this person if you weren't disabled? And I was like, dude, if I wasn't disabled, I'd be like everybody else and take advantage of my body, not care, you know, like, it's like all the stereotypes, I wouldn't know any different. But because of the disability, I've had to adapt and learn, and I do think there is something really essential in the fact that when you've been disabled, since, like you said, you were in a wheelchair at 2, I was sick when I was 3, so that's all we know. And people are like, you must be depressed, why are you so happy? It's like, if this is all I know, what do I have to be depressed about?
Right.
You know, so
do I wish I could take long hikes in the woods and really smell the deep smells of wet leaves and feel the drips of dew coming off the pines? I mean, I could probably do that if I found a trail somewhere, but just the act of doing that. Yeah, I wish I could do that.
Right.
But there's little time in life that is really worth spending thinking about those things. And if you do think about those things, I think that if you can kind of accept that that's where your physical limitations may lie, then it also allows you to appreciate what things you can do.
Right.
And what you do have.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. This has been a great, wonderful interview, and I'm so honored to actually get this chance to talk to you. And
I really had a wonderful time. Thank you so much for asking.
Thank you.